are listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. Good afternoon. You're listening to Praxis on a brand new time slot. Hopefully you heard that announcement. And if you're a regular weekday commuter listening, here's a brand new show for you, maybe new to you. You're listening to Praxis. Praxis receives support from the Smith Barbieri Progressive Fund, a charitable foundation. Information at smith-barbieri.com. And as I said, this might be your first time hearing the show because it is my first time on this time slot. I've been on Saturdays for quite some time, but my schedule's changing up after this long summer, which I spent on the road doing a road show of this program, which is basically a public affairs program, talking politics, talking community organizing, social change theory and practice, and all the rest. I'm your host, Taylor, and hopefully you enjoy this first show of mine at this new time slot. It's about half interviews, half solo. Today is one of those solo days, and I think it's a pretty good show I've got lined up here because today is the International Day of Peace. It's every September 21st, and this year it happens to be a Monday on the same week I start Mondaying Praxis. So peace will be, we'll be roving all over the place on that topic, from the really practical matters of peace. What is it? Is it just an absence of conflict? Is it something that we more proactively work towards? And then moving into some more kind of, more personal looks at it, thinking about the idea of peace on a personal level as opposed to a societal, global level. And rambling along with some help from some very smart people in the present and the past, and we'll see what happens. So hope you enjoy it if you're a new listener. Thanks to all the old listeners, the steady people who keep us alive. We just finished our fall on-air fund drive, and we're pretty darn successful in meeting our goals, and that's all because of people like you. So thanks so much for listening, and especially for supporting the station. If you missed that fund drive, you know, you can always donate to keep us powered and projecting people like me, people like our great music DJs, everyone else who's part of the KYRS family. So thanks to everyone who already did that. And you can visit kyrs.org to find out how to become a member, become part of our big clan here if you aren't already. Lots of prizes, lots of good stuff. So, diving into the show, as I said, today is International Day of Peace. That is, it's been in existence for some times, declared by the UN as a day to both observe peace, but every year they choose a different theme for peace, and it's a good thing. I mean, in some ways it's simply symbolic to call an International Day of Peace, but in other ways it can be a really effective catalyst for moving things forward. And I'm going to start with something newsy before we dive into all the rest. So this is from the United Nations News Center from today. The United Nations today observed the International Day of Peace with Secretary General Ban Ki-moon appealing to all warring parties to lay down their weapons and observe a global ceasefire and, quote, stop the killings and the destruction and create space for lasting peace, end quote. The UN chief made the call at the Peace Bell Ceremony, which kicked off the series of events at UN headquarters in New York for the day, which is observed annually on 21st of September and whose theme this year is Partnerships for Peace, Dignity for All. Something I'm going to come back to in a sec. He said, quote, just as surely as striking this bell makes a sound, we will continue to hammer this point and demand peace, Mr. Bond said. It's an interesting choice of language for using hammering as a, method for peace, which is something we'll talk about too. He said, we live at a moment of peril. but also drew attention to the fact that this is also an era of great promise. In a matter of days, leaders from across the globe will gather at the United Nations to adopt the 2030 Agenda, our 15-year plan to achieve sustainable development, the UN chief said. This is fundamental to ushering in a life of dignity for all, where poverty is history and peace is paramount. And that's the main gist of that. So no news as of yet. I haven't sifted through all the news to see whether that ceasefire was observed, but unfortunately, given the amount of turmoil that's currently going on, I tend to focus on turmoil that is being generated by the U.S., since that's the country where I live, pay taxes, am entangled in whether or not I desire to be. Given the level of our military engagement everywhere, we'll see if that's observed. We'll see whether ISIS and other groups like that observe it. So I'm going to get in, like I said, to some of the nuts and bolts of what is the kind of state of the world regarding peace right now, and then move into how do we get to be more peaceful? What does that mean? Has there ever been world peace? You know, I also always think of kind of the cliche about Miss America, you know, what's your platform? World peace, like world peace. And that's been made into somewhat of a joke. And I think it's partially because people see that as a really unattainable goal for humans. And I don't think that it's an unattainable goal whatsoever. Many people would agree with me. And there's a lot of division as to how we get there. So that's my Miss America speech for the day, is world peace. And something that really frustrates me when I speak to people about this, which I do frequently in my normal life, because it's something I'm interested in and passionate about and something of an idealist. Again, there's probably new listeners to the show who have never heard it before. You know, I'm really into, and many other people I have interviewed and work with are also into, this idea that we can turn the ship and we can become better. And there's nothing inherently human about being violent and conquest and all of that. So something that people like to bring up is like, oh, there's never been a time when there was peace, and therefore like there never can be because there's no precedent for it. I would disagree. I think there is precedent for it. And I'm going to just share this little chunk from someone who is a scholar on this topic, because I am not, though I am in a casual sense, because I really want to prove that that's true to people. It's important to me that that be true. So, but this is from Dr. Hilary Shaw. And it's just a very short little blurb. This appeared in the Guardian's notes a couple years ago, where they just take a little question like that and have a few people respond to it. So her response to the question, has the world ever been at peace? And I'll probably interrupt this from time to time to clarify, add things, make snide comments, etc. She says, first, one must define peace and war. There's no clear division, but a continuum of violence, from a minor neighbor assault through murder, clan attacks, terrorist incidents, subversion and sabotage, through to full-blown interstate war. Let's assume that by peace, one means an absence of full state-sponsored war, because there will always be the occasional murder, terrorist outrage, etc., but these do not affect the peace of most people. In that case, to have war, you need a state to wage one. Then the question is, when did the first states come into existence? The answer is probably when agriculture became widespread, because mobile hunter-gatherer societies have few assets to plunder, and their numbers are severely limited by the availability of prey. However, once agriculture is adopted by a society, there are many irreversible changes. Crops must be stored between harvests, necessitating a security force, an administration, and a ruler to organize this, and a tax system to pay for it. Also, technologists to develop weapons of protection. Population then rises way beyond what hunter-gathering could sustain, making the transition to a centralist, militarized state irreversible. Then some states will have failed harvests, so they attack the next-door state for food. So when you next look out over a peaceful, idyllic, rural landscape, blame what you see for starting mankind's endless series of wars. And Dr. Hilary Shaw is not the first or the last to point out that connection between agriculture really being like the moment that we can pinpoint as the moment when civilization began as we know it. And many times, to my frustration, people equate the history of civilization as an entity which is only 10,000 or a little more years old, with the totality of human history, which is simply very much untrue. Most of our history, the vast majority of our history, is pre-civilization and based on, as she said, hunter-gatherer societies living in direct and unavoidable connection with land bases, and the health of those societies depending largely on the health of the ecology they're very much part of, rather than on top of. And agriculture is kind of the first big shift in that direction. But as she points out, you know, once that shift is made, it becomes fairly irreversible, partially because of the ecologically destructive aspects of agriculture, interrupting a series of systems to create something that is specifically for humans rather than for the entire system, usually monocropping, though not all early agriculture was monocropped to the extent that we have today, which is pretty wild and has caused more devastation and also arguably more violence than we've seen. If you look at India today, and even as we begin to look at this crisis growing around this decades-long drought in California that's really coming to a peak, spawning what no one really calls a refugee crisis, but soon we'll begin to look more like one as people from those areas affected by the drought and our dependence on food from that area, you know, it supplies either a third or half of the nation's food. As that literally dries up, we will soon probably experience some of those reactions that frequently through history have been violent related to agriculture. So I thought that was interesting. And also that she says it's a continuum. You know, peace isn't unrelated from war, but war isn't the only option. You know, there's these like levels of violence, and her assertion that interpersonal violence doesn't quite count the same way that war does is an interesting one. And this is just a little more historical context. This is from Jeff Clifton. He says, this is a tricky one. It's tempting to go back to ancient history and pick on years or even centuries when nothing much seems to have happened. But this may be misleading, as the historical record is far from complete. Military forces as we understand them today were organized first by the Sumerians, who began to use bronze in the manufacture of weapons and also invented an ass-drawn war chariot. Before that, it's likely that some form of militia existed to defend the early cities. For example, Jericho. Whether much fighting took place and how widespread it was cannot accurately be determined. More recently, I would suggest that the mid-1920s might be a contender. Following the end of the civil wars in Ireland and Russia and the beginning of the Chaco War in South America, 1928, I can find no record of any significant fighting, although I suspect there must have been some. So, and that's interesting when you look at the 1920s, because obviously while there weren't outright wars, it was sort of a lull where a lot of colonial powers, European colonial powers, and the U.S. as a growing empire were very much active. And while colonialism isn't permanent war, you know, once places are kind of conquered and settled into and made part of or subservient to the empire, I personally and many other people would consider that still ongoing violence. So just because it isn't war doesn't mean that it's peace. So what is peace? We'll get there, I think. But it is an interesting question, and people have many different answers. I asked for some quotes, thoughts, essays, songs about peace from people, and I'd still love to receive those. I always like to have this be a collaborative project, this show, even when I don't have an interviewee. So if that's something you're interested in as a listener, you can find the show on Facebook at facebook.com/praxisradio. That link is also on my show page at kyrs.org, and you can join in there. You can also send me an email directly at praxis@kyrs.org. So if you feel like chiming in on this, if you have strong feelings about peace or anything else, you can send them my way and we'll hash it out and maybe end up on the show. Who knows? So a really interesting, I always have mixed feelings about these types of projects where we measure things like peace and war. And I think it's important that we have numbers and we have a scientific and accurate count of what exactly is going on, and that we study these things as they happen. I also tend to get frustrated by the amount of resources that go into that when those resources could be put into fairly obvious solutions for, you know, ending poverty, empowering people, and all the rest. But there is a group called Vision of Humanity that creates a global peace index study every year. And they use 23 different indicators to examine what peace is and where various nations, and then even states within the US, provinces within Canada, subregions of many countries, are changing according to those indicators and whether they're becoming more peaceful or less peaceful. So this is part of their report, Trends in Peace. The abstract simply says the world has become slightly less peaceful over the last 8 years. So it's really fascinating. If you're a data person, I am interested in data despite my mixed relationship with it. They have really interesting stuff, and I'll be posting all of these links in the notes for the podcast, which will be posted. There's a link at kyrs.org. It's in the sidebar at my website, which is truthscout.net, and also will exist elsewhere. Sorry, I'm distracted by my browser doing strange things. So anyway, this is from their summary at Vision of Humanity, and their site is visionofhumanity.org, and they have all of these reports and information about how they put their information together, infographics, videos, and the rest. So they say, the world has become slightly less peaceful over the last 8 years, deteriorating by 2.4%. However, this decrease in peacefulness has not been evenly spread, with 76 countries improving while 86 deteriorated. The Middle East and North Africa has suffered the largest decline of any region in the world, deteriorating 11% in 8 years. This decrease in peacefulness reverses a long-term trend dating back to the Second World War, which had seen steady increases in peace, especially after the end of the Cold War. Conflict and war, particularly colonial and interstate conflicts, have decreased consistently, as has the number of people killed in armed conflicts. So there's a little more detail on that I'm also going to share from their video, which the audio of is quite sufficient. So I'm going to play that for you real quick and then get a little bit into some of the numbers that they don't share. And again, this is from Vision of Humanity. They put together the Global Peace Index, and this is the newest, really recently released this summer, their Global Peace Index summary.
Is the world becoming more peaceful, or is it spiraling into cycles of violence and conflict? To answer this complex question, researchers from the Institute for Economics and Peace have analysed 23 different types of data in 162 countries over the last 8 years. They found that this question isn't as straightforward as it had first seemed. This graph shows changes in peace over time. Lines travelling towards the bottom of the graph show countries becoming more peaceful. This line shows the global average level of peace over the last 8 years. If you look closely, you can see peace has fluctuated slightly, and today the world is slightly less peaceful than it was in 2008. However, when we take a look behind the global average, we can see that there is a growing gap between the most and least peaceful countries in the world. Many countries in the world's most peaceful region, Europe, have reached historically high levels of peace. This is largely due to a reduction in the number of homicides, a decrease in military expenditure, and the withdrawal of forces from Iraq and Afghanistan. 15 of the top 20 most peaceful countries are now in Europe. So why aren't we seeing a global trend towards peace? A rise in civil unrest in the world's least peaceful countries has caused an escalation of violence and conflict, which is impacting the global average. The intensity of armed conflict has risen dramatically, with the number of people killed in conflicts last year reaching 180,000, a 267% increase from 2010. This has led to a sharp rise in the number of refugees and internally displaced people, reaching almost 1% of the global population. Terrorism continues to rise, with over 20,000 people killed in attacks last year. 85% of those deaths occurred in just 5 of the world's least peaceful countries. The Middle East and North Africa is the region that suffered the greatest decline in peace in the last year, with a dramatic rise in civil conflict and terrorism. This region is also home to the world's least peaceful countries, Syria and Iraq. So if we go back to the question at hand, we can see that the world is becoming less peaceful. But more significantly, it is becoming increasingly divided, as the gap between the most and least peaceful countries is becoming wider. The Global Peace Index is the only statistical analysis of its kind that focuses on understanding the complex dynamics of peace in order to provide the world with a roadmap for creating a more peaceful future. Explore the data for yourself and get the facts on the interactive Global Peace Index map.
So again, that is from the Global Peace Index, comprised that way. And I think it's important that they point out that gap and the fact that that division is growing. And it looks a lot like maps of economic inequality in the U.S. It looks a lot like many other maps that I and many other people might attribute to this legacy that we're discussing at the top of the hour of colonialism. So and it's also disturbing that, you know, while European countries, even the U.S., you know, are becoming more peaceful on paper, that these places, I don't think it's a coincidence, you know, that Syria, Iraq, Libya are on these top least peaceful areas. And what's especially disturbing is that that reinforces a lot of racist and colonial narratives about those places. If we detach this level of peace in these places from the context of years of colonialism, years of occupation, it puts the responsibility on the people who were not the aggressors in that situation and reinforces these narratives that we hear over and over again, that, you know, those people are just violent, these places just aren't as civilized, you know, things that you will hear increasingly as Islamophobia becomes more the norm, as racism is expressed very openly by people in the U.S. political establishment and in Europe. So I think it's important that they point out that gap, but also that we acknowledge what that gap is and think about colonialism when we think about peace, rather than just official war. You know, even if you're not officially at war somewhere, but you're sending arms to people who are doing violence there, or you sent a bunch of arms there 5 years ago and then are surprised that people are using them in the present, that's a factor. So there's a little more I wanted to share from this report before moving on to some more peaceful things. I realize it's kind of ironic to do a show on the International Day of Peace and focus so much on conflict, but we're putting it there to show current state, and then we'll kind of zoom back and think about what a different vision would look like, what a peaceful world might look like. And so, for instance, something that's interesting, they do measure things like arms export, but usually just being a country that exports a lot of weaponry, like Switzerland, for example, is historically known for being neutral, and they score consistently the highest or closest to the highest on this peace index. But they also add a caveat that they export a lot of arms from Switzerland per capita, not compared to somewhere like the U.S. that exports so many and it's such a big part of our economy, but that still happens. And I just almost feel like from a data standpoint, that should affect their score somehow, because they're perpetuating violence. But it measures where peace is actually happening geographically, rather than a map of where the sources are, which would also be interesting. But no one is really measuring that in exactly the same way. This still has a lot of good insight. So most of these highlights were in that video, but they say in their results here, Syria remains the world's least peaceful country, followed by Iraq and Afghanistan. The country that suffered the most severe deterioration in peace was Libya, which now ranks 149th of 162 countries. Ukraine suffered the second largest deterioration following a popular revolution which brought down the administration of Viktor Yanukovych. Russia moved to destabilize the country, meaning it scored poorly on organized conflict indicators. 2014 was marked by contradictory trends. On the one hand, many countries in the OECD achieved historically high levels of peace, while on the other, strife-torn nations, especially in the Middle East and North Africa, became more violent. That's a real concern. As these conflicts become even more intractable, they spread terrorism to other states. They also say the world is less peaceful today than it was in 2008. The indicators that have deteriorated the most are the numbers of refugees and internally displaced persons, the number of deaths from internal conflict, and the impact of terrorism. Last year alone, it is estimated that 20,000 people were killed in terrorist attacks, up from an average of 2,000 a year only 10 years ago. Only two indicators have markedly improved since 2008, UN peacekeeping funding and external conflicts fought. The number of deaths from external conflict has fallen from 1,982 to 410 after the last 8 years. So that's very interesting, but it also points, you can't help but notice that those years, that span of years, 2005 to 2015, the last 10 years, and then 2008 to the present, which is when some of this other measuring was done, there's been, as we all know, in this country, a war on terror, that is failing incredibly due to these numbers. You know, the fact that 10 times as many people were killed in terrorist attacks shows that, you know, having a war on a concept like terror is probably not a very great plan, and that it is also just not working on paper. So, and also showing that external conflicts being fought decreasing, also, I think, just shows the sophistication of some of these colonial wars and the ways that the U.S. has been waging war in a very shadowy, underhanded way over at least since the Cold War, during and after in Central America, and then throughout the Middle East, with this very intentional destabilization. With the help of the intelligence apparatus, the empowerment of despotic leaders and the arming of those areas, while never invading, never being officially at war in any of these places, still managing to sow a lot of violence and then point back to the country that this has happened to as the ultimate source of the violence, while keeping our hands feeling relatively clean. That's a process that's been really advanced by the U.S. and by other colonial powers. And I think we see it coming to maturity when we look at these numbers in some ways. There are other ones. But they also have an interesting indicator, positive peace. They say that peace is more than just the absence of conflict. Positive peace can be understood as the attitudes, structures, and institutions that underpin peaceful societies. The research shows that in countries with higher levels of positive peace, resistance movements are less likely to become violent and are more likely to successfully achieve concessions from the state. That's a tricky sentence. And I'd be curious to dive more into that. I just discovered this report a few hours ago, so I haven't really taken it apart as much as I'd like to. But again, I'll post that link. And if you're wondering what on earth you're listening to and what I'm talking about, you're listening to Praxis on KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio, Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. This is my first day on this new time slot, back on a weekday afternoon. Really happy to be here. I love a weekend spot, but I think that there's totally different people listening right now. So if you are listening and you like the show, or you want to find out more, maybe you don't like the show and you want to contact me and yell at me, also fine. You can go to kyrs.org, look on the programs pages, find Praxis. You can find links to the podcast there, past shows, more information, and my contact. So I'm doing a show about peace today on the International Day of Peace. And I think we've spent quite enough time on conflict and war. So I'm going to share some. I have a lot of great quotes that I really like to use quotes from people I admire on this show as kind of a jumping off point, and just sharing some of those with you because I think it's It's a really nice way to get the gist of something without reading that whole long thing. And when we only have an hour, sometimes that's all we can do. So there's another excellent resource I want to point people to that I probably won't have time to share, but it's a scholarly collaboration, the International Journal on World Peace. And it's well-researched and has a wide variety of articles. I ended up reading quite a bit of it today. Have things I want to share from the abstract, but I don't know if we'll have time again. But International Journal on World Peace, I recommend for anyone who wants to do some more peace reading today in observance of the International Day of Peace. And there, the theme for this, I believe it's a quarterly journal, is Conquest or Coexistence, the Future of a Post-Colonial World. So that ties into a lot of what I was just mentioning about colonialism as violence, even though it isn't war, outright war. So I think someone we often associate with peace or ideas of world peace is the Dalai Lama. And this is a really great article from the current, the 14th Dalai Lama, called A Human Approach to World Peace, which kind of brings us to this bridge that I want to make between between this really macro level, the stuff I was just looking at, you know, indicators country by country on this huge scale of how peaceful things are. A lot of times those can feel like insurmountable, unapproachable issues to individual people, which is why not a lot of people are involved in ongoing peace movements. They tend to flare up right when something happens, and people tend to be discouraged afterwards because, in my opinion, the process of appealing to state power, particularly somewhere like the U.S. that's currently, you know, functionally an oligarchy, with the democratic apparatus really well co-opted by a powerful financial elite, it's not likely that people, as we saw when the U.S. invaded Iraq, it's not likely at this point, unfortunately, due to how intractable that system appears to be, for even hundreds of thousands, even millions, as when Iraq was invaded in 2003, even millions of people in the streets making a really passionate appeal, that still happened. And now we see that Iraq is the second most violent, least peaceful, rather, country in the world. So that can be really discouraging for people to see the 1960s unfold the way that they did, and then to see where we are today. It can be really discouraging. And I think that there are other ways that we can work for peace on a personal level that are related to those movements. Those movements are still very important, obviously, but maybe coming up with a more satisfying, because that's part of it, but also strategic way to work for peace. So that's kind of the bridge we're going to make. And I really liked this article from the Dalai Lama, so I'm going to read you some chunks of it. It's quite long, but yet again, those links will be available in the notes on the podcast. So it's called A Human Approach to World Peace. He says, "When we rise in the morning and listen to the radio or read the newspaper, we are confronted with the same sad news: violence, crime, wars, and disasters. I cannot recall a single day without a report of something terrible happening somewhere. Even in these modern times, it is clear that one's precious life is not safe. No former generation has had to experience so much bad news as we face today. This constant awareness of fear and tension should make any sensitive and compassionate person question seriously the progress of our modern world. It is ironic that the more serious problems emanate from the more industrial advanced societies. Science and technology have worked wonders in many fields, but the basic human problems remain. There's unprecedented literacy, yet this universal education does not seem to have fostered goodness, but only mental restlessness and discontent instead. There is no doubt about the increase in our material progress and technology, but somehow this is not sufficient, as we have not yet succeeded in bringing about peace and happiness or in overcoming suffering. We can only conclude that there must be something seriously wrong with our progress and development, and if we do not check it in time, there could be disastrous consequences for the future of humanity. I am not at all against science and technology. They have contributed immensely to the overall experience of humankind, to our material comfort and well-being, and to our greater understanding of the world we live in. But if we give too much emphasis to science and technology, we are in danger of losing touch with those aspects of human knowledge and understanding that aspire toward honesty and altruism. Science and technology, though capable of creating immeasurable material comfort, cannot replace the age-old spiritual and humanitarian values that have largely shaped world civilization in all its national forms as we know it today. No one can deny the unprecedented material benefit of science and technology, but our basic human problems remain. We are still faced with the same, if not more, suffering, fear, and tension. Thus, it is only logical to try to strike a balance between material developments on the one hand and development of spiritual human values on the other. In order to bring about this great adjustment, we need to revive our humanitarian values. I am sure that many people share my concern about the present worldwide moral crisis and will join in my appeal to all humanitarians and religious practitioners who also share this concern to help make our societies more compassionate, just, and equitable. I do not speak as a Buddhist or even as a Tibetan, nor do I speak as an expert on international politics, though I unavoidably comment on these matters. Rather, I speak simply as a human being, as an upholder of the humanitarian values that are the bedrock not only of Mahayana Buddhism, but of all the great world religions. From this perspective, I share with you my personal outlook that 1. Universal humanitarianism is essential to solve global problems. 2. Compassion is the pillar of world peace. 3. All world religions are already for world peace in this way, as are all humanitarians of whatever ideology. And 4. Each individual has a universal responsibility to shape institutions to serve human needs. And I want to keep going on this, but I just want to respond to those because I think that, you know, this is something that is A, common sense, and B, beautifully written. And just that the idea of humanitarianism is an interesting one. You know, this, that we should care for each other seems pretty basic and important, but, many methods have been devised over the years through this history of civilization. Again, I don't think it's an inherently human problem. I think it's largely a problem with how we've organized our society, and the way that that is built on itself, as he points out here, the Dalai Lama, through science and technology becoming more and more aggressive, more advanced, more powerful, more able to kind of attack more parts of our lives. So, yes, universal humanitarianism. And that is sounds great to many people on paper, but then we have these deep-seated divisions, which are all illusions, it should be pointed out, you know, of race, of nationality, nationalism being a big problem in my mind, that's a barrier to achieving this kind of thing. I'm wondering how to get past that. But compassion being the way to work on that. So I think that as far as if people want to be more peaceful people in the grand sense of things, I think it definitely has to start with interpersonal relationships and having compassion for people you encounter in your daily life, just to build the skills. I think as those skills get built, it becomes a lot more easier to envision being compassionate to someone who is now a stranger to you, or maybe very foreign, or maybe from a culture you're not comfortable with, or someone you've been taught by your culture to see as a terrorist or a bad person or a not advanced person or any of these destructive ideas. Those are all examples that come from our culture, but it's true across many. His third point, that all world religions are already for world peace in this way, as are all humanitarians of whatever ideology. I think that is true if we look at the written doctrines of the main world religions, but the ways that they've all, you know, I mean, we can look at a great many examples around the world of those doctrines being twisted into nationalist ideologies, into and being militarized, essentially, taking these ideas that are, you know, about peace and love and using them to propagate violence and domination is a common story. And I think that that is a problem for all of those institutions and practitioners to look at, and for people outside of it who, you know, I know a lot of very nationalistic, tribal atheists as well. So they don't get a free pass on that either. I think it's just trying to find a consistent worldview, a consistent outlook that can also be lived even when that's difficult. So, and that comes to his fourth point. Each individual has a universal responsibility to shape institutions and serve human needs. So, how those institutions are shaped is complicated, and some institutions are much more accessible to us as individuals than others. But if all people engage with those things, then it's much easier to force that kind of change. We're talking about hammering and forcing in order to make peace. But I don't think peace has to be, you know, wimpy or diminutive by any means, personally. And that's something that if you study nonviolence, you'll find there's a lot of great stories of being very forceful for peace and having it work very well. So there's quite a bit more here, and I do want to, I'll read this second chunk of it because I really like it. And again, this part that I'm sharing with you is partially my comments, but it's from the Dalai Lama writing about a human approach to world peace on this, the International Day of Peace. So this is his section, Solving Human Problems Through Transforming Human Attitudes. He says, of the many problems we face today, some are natural calamities and must be accepted and faced with equanimity. Others, however, are of our own making, created by misunderstanding, and can be corrected. One such type arises from the conflict of ideologies, political or religious, when people fight each other for petty ends, losing sight of the basic humanity that binds us all together as a single human family. We must remember that the different religions, ideologies, and political systems of the world are meant for human beings to achieve happiness. We must not lose sight of this fundamental goal, and at no time should we place means above ends. The supremacy of humanity over matter and ideology must always be maintained. And I hope that what he means, I'm interrupting for a second. The reason I like this is because I think of the word humanity, including all of biology. Like, I think of it in an ecological sense, not in the sense of humans as something that is separate from the rest of nature, because I think that's really problematic. So I'm assuming, based on the fact that the Dalai Lama is Buddhist, that too is what he means when he says humanity. But that is why I'm sharing that. I'm not sharing that as like the supremacy of humanity, meaning the supremacy of human beings. I mean, like the supremacy of like the whole thing of like what we know of life on Earth. Anyway, continuing, by far the greatest single danger facing humankind, in fact, all living beings on our planet, there we go, is the threat of nuclear destruction. I need not elaborate on this danger, but I would like to appeal to all the leaders of the nuclear powers who literally hold the future of the world in their hands, to the scientists and technicians who continue to create these awesome weapons of destruction, and to all the people at large who are in a position to influence their leaders. I appeal to them to exercise their sanity and begin to work at dismantling and destroying all nuclear weapons. We know that in the event of a nuclear war, there will be no victors because there will be no survivors. Is it not frightening just to contemplate such inhuman and heartless destruction? And is it not logical that we should remove the cause for our own destruction when we know the cause and have both the time and the means to do so? Often we cannot overcome our problems because we either do not know the cause of, or if we understand it, do not have the means to remove it. This is not the case with the nuclear threat. Whether they belong to more evolved species like humans or to simpler ones such as animals, all beings primarily seek peace, comfort, and security. Life is as dear to the mute animal as it is to any human being. Even the simplest insect strives for protection from dangers that threaten its life. Just as each one of us wants to live and does not wish to die, so it is with all other creatures in the universe, though their power to affect this is a different matter. Broadly speaking, there are two types of happiness and suffering, mental and physical, and of the two, I believe that mental suffering and happiness are the more acute. Hence, I stress the training of the mind to endure suffering and attain a more lasting state of happiness. However, I also have a more general and concrete idea of happiness, a combination of inner peace, economic development, and above all, world peace. To achieve such goals, I feel it is necessary to develop a sense of universal responsibility, a deep concern for all, irrespective of creed, color, sex, or nationality. The premise behind this idea of universal responsibility is the simple fact that in general terms, all others' desires are the same as mine. Every being wants happiness and does not want suffering. If we, as intelligent human beings, do not accept this fact, there will be more and more suffering on this planet. If we adopt a self-centered approach to life and constantly try to use others for our own self-interest, we may gain temporary benefits, but in the long run, we will not succeed in achieving even personal happiness, and world peace will be quite out of the question. And he goes on to discuss why is self-interest, mutual interest, which is I enlightened self-interest, which I consider, I like to use enlightened self-interest. The idea that in looking out for yourself, if you're truly looking out for yourself in a holistic sense, it includes looking out for others around you, for the ecological web that you are part of, whether you want to be or not, and all the rest. So that's a much longer piece than what I just shared with you. And if you're interested in hearing the rest of it, I will post that in the notes. You can find the podcast at praxisradio509.podomatic.com. You can find that link, since it's a long address, at kyrs.org under programs Praxis. Also working on getting the podcast back on the KYRS site, so you can subscribe straight from there in the iTunes store. That is all in flux right now, but very, very soon to come. So just follow along. You can join the conversation on Facebook, facebook.com/praxisradio. You can email me if you need any of these links, praxis, P-R-A-X-I-S at kyrs.org. And that's the show you're listening to. I'm your host, Taylor, finishing up the hour on this brand new time slot. I'll be here every Monday at 3 p.m. for the foreseeable future. So that was a little bit from the Dalai Lama about world peace. As I said at the beginning of the hour, this is the Miss America World Peace program as part of the International Day of Peace. And I pulled some quotes, and some people sent me some quotes about peace that I just think are really lovely, and I may comment on them briefly, but then I'm going to outro with some music today rather than intro, because it's something that pretty much consistently makes me cry, and I don't need to be crying on the radio my first Monday on the air. This is one of my favorites. It's from Albert Einstein, who I think we all agree culturally. He's pretty much agreed to be a pretty smart guy. We call people his name if they are smart. So that's something, that's quite a legacy to leave. And he said, peace cannot be kept by force. It can only be achieved by understanding. And he also said some wonderful things about nationalism that I like to share that I think are interrelated. But that's the one today. So the idea that you can fight for peace, that you can achieve peace by, you know, bombing or fighting or anything like that are maybe temporarily, you know, the material conditions of people's lives may be more peaceful if you take out a specific person or that theory, I think, is really flawed, though. And Einstein agreed with me, so it's possible that I'm right, that understanding and compassion and getting to the root of why is there a disagreement in the first place, why is there violence in the first place, is the only long-term way to do this. And it's not something that's been deeply explored, I don't think, during our history of civilization, but we need to get at it. So I also really love this quote. It's a common one, but I just like to read it any chance I get. It's Martin Luther King Jr., I refuse to accept the view that mankind is so tragically bound to the starless midnight of racism and war that the bright daybreak of peace and brotherhood can never become reality. I believe that unarmed truth and unconditional love will have the final word. Me too, Martin. And I also, this is a good tie-in to the Dalai Lama. This is Mother Teresa. She said, if we have no peace, it is because we have forgotten that we belong to each other. Which is what we're talking about with this interconnection and compassion. Oh, there's so many more. I took a bunch more and now I'm running out of time. One I really like are, it One that I really like is, sorry, verb tense, George Bernard Shaw said, peace is not only better than war, but infinitely more arduous. And I think that's a common theme that I kind of wanted to get to a little more than I did. But it's hard work. It's not as though peace is just like the day we all sit back and everything's fine all of a sudden when we can be lazy. I think it's much more difficult to solve problems nonviolently. It's much more difficult to communicate on an interpersonal level nonviolently and to seek understanding. It takes a great deal of effort, and it takes a lot of effort over a lot of time, and it doesn't end. It's a process that continues forever. Whereas violence, if you punch someone in the face, they stop saying something you're uncomfortable with. And it's a very immediate solution, but it's not a good solution long term. So I really liked that George Bernard Shaw quote. I'm going to finish before I play you music with one of my favorite quotes of all time that a friend sent to me. It's up on my wall. It has some to do with peace, but it more just like motivates me to be a good person. So this is Howard Zinn, who I like to call the grandfather of this show, because reading his work has been hugely influential to me. And I just really like him, and I wish I could have got to meet him. So this is Howard Zinn. He says, to be hopeful in bad times is not just foolishly romantic. It is based on the fact that human history is a history not only of cruelty, but also of compassion, sacrifice, courage, kindness. What we choose to emphasize in this complex history will determine our lives. If we see only the worst, it destroys our capacity to do something. If we remember those times and places, and there are so many, where people have behaved magnificently, this gives us the energy to act and at least the possibility of sending this spinning top of a world in a different direction. And if we do act, in however small a way, we don't have to wait for some grand utopian future. The future is an infinite succession of presents, and to live now as we think human beings should live, in defiance of all that is bad around us, is itself a marvelous victory. So that's where I'm going to close for you today. I don't know, do something peaceful for this International Day of Peace. I always also think of John Lennon and Yoko Ono because of my long-term obsession with Yoko Ono as a just someone I like, and the two of them having their bed in for peace. So if you want to have a bed in for peace today, maybe you're at work now or on your way home from work, just stay in bed. If we all did that for a day, peace, particularly if you're directly engaged in something that is violent directly or indirectly in your life as a job. A lot of us are kind of caught in this web of violence. I don't know, think about ways to get out of that and just find a little inner peace, help somebody out with something. There are many small things you can do. So because of that, I'm going to close with Give Peace a Chance, performed by both of them in collaboration with quite a few others. So you've been listening to Praxis on KYRS. First Monday show. I'll be back every Monday at 3 p.m. Next week, I have a great show planned with many grassroots activists from Pasco, Washington, from Tri-Cities Community Solutions, who have been working since February seeking justice in the case of Antonio Zambrano Montes, who was killed by the police and who recently faced no charges. So there's going to be updates about that case, a little context of what's going on, and more information about how people can get involved in that. So have a great rest of your afternoon. Here's Give Peace a Chance.